We talk a lot on this podcast about chess improvement, but when it comes to improving your hiring processes, Indeed is the platform you need. Indeed has over 350 million global monthly visitors, and it has a matching engine that helps you find quality work candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with your candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Years ago, when I was running a chess teaching business, I found it hard to find good help, and I had to go through a lot of back and forth to even screen potential candidates. Indeed allows you to do those things efficiently in one place. Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed for hiring, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of Perpetual Chess will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility if you go to Indeed.com/chess. Just go to Indeed.com/chess right now, and you'll be supporting our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast, Indeed.com/chess. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, everyone. I'm Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. On Perpetual Chess, I have weekly conversations with the chess world's best players, promoters, and educators about their lives, careers, current projects, and best practices. For more information, go to perpetualchesspod.com. Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to Perpetual Chess. I'm going to introduce this week's guest in a moment's time, but I just wanted to give a quick heads up and ask a favor of you guys. So I've been working on a survey for listeners. I've gotten to know a lot of you through the World Wide Web since Perpetual Chess's creation, and some of you, of course, I know in person, but it would be helpful for me to have more information about like what your rating is, like what your listening habits are, what you're interested in hearing more of, what you're interested in hearing less of. So I created a survey that takes maybe 5 minutes, and it would be a great service to me if you guys could just fill it out. So what you should do is go to the website, perpetualchesspod.com, and then you'll be able to click on survey from there and take the survey. I'll also post it on Twitter and Facebook and stuff like that. Even if you're not a regular listener, or maybe there's things you don't like about the podcast, I am open to hearing all of it. This is kind of a rare opportunity. I'm going to leave this survey open for a few weeks, but after that, I'm not going to be bugging you guys about it for a while. So I would really appreciate it if you could provide me with a little more information so I can keep trying to make the show better. With that long spiel out of the way, let's get to this week's episode. So my guest this week is a personal friend of mine who's been a fixture on the chess scene in the U.S., although he hails from up north in Canada. And he's also made a transition to finance. Of course, grandmaster at chess, now works at a hedge fund, pillar of the New York chess scene, Pascal Charbonneau. Pascal, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Ben. It's a pleasure.
So, Pascal, why don't we start by just, I think most people will have heard of you who are listening to this, particularly in North America, but just to give people a little more background, you were one of Canada's top players, went to UMBC, on a chess scholarship, as many of our guests have gone to various colleges on a chess scholarship, and then you made your way into the finance world. So you still keep a toe in the chess world, but why don't you tell people what you're up to these days, what your day-to-day life is like?
Sure. So I think, you know, when I grew up, I never thought of myself as someone who was very likely to be a professional chess player. I think maybe, you know, I started to consider that possibility at some point. But then ultimately, like you said, I ended up in college at UMBC. And, you know, afterwards, I started looking for a job. I realized, quite frankly, that, you know, having focused more on chess for, you know, the college years, that it wasn't so easy to just get a start in finance. But I was fortunate enough to find a job eventually at a small brokerage firm by the New York Stock Exchange in, you know, in the city. And so I started doing, you know, what we call basically institutional brokerage and sales, and then transitioned a couple of years later to a hedge fund called Alpine Associates, where I've been for almost 10 years. I started basically as a trader slash, you know, right-hand man for the fund, you know, working with one of the portfolio managers, and, you know, I've sort of worked my way up since then. The fund, you know, manages, I don't know, something like about $2 billion. And we invest in a strategy that's called merger arbitrage. And that might get people a little bit confused, but essentially we look at stocks that are in the process of getting acquired. And it sounds very exciting because it sounds like, you know, companies getting acquired, you probably get a large premium, but typically it's more like an insurance business almost, where once a deal gets announced and a company is going to be acquired, there's a whole process that goes on that can take anywhere from a few months to over a year. And essentially you're compensated for the risk of having that position, that the deal might not go through, and that then the premium goes away. And so we try to you know, get in situations where we believe the odds are in our favor, and basically that's what I work on day to day, you know, in a nutshell.
Okay. Yeah. And I've talked to you about it a little in the past. I don't live in, as listeners probably know, I don't live in New York anymore, but we used to see each other once in a while. And yeah, that's a good description. I think you basically covered the bases. I mean, when something gets bought on the public market, it's usually at a premium. So if you buy and hold, as long as the deal doesn't go, if the deal blows up, it costs you money. But otherwise, it can be a relatively lower risk way to make money.
Yeah. And to be clear, like a premium will be 25 or 30%, and on day one the stock might go up 22%, and you're trying to collect the last three, you know, to 5%, something like that.
Right, trying to assess if it's if there's still meat to be picked off that bone, as it were.
Exactly.
So, what's your day to day like doing this work?
Yeah, so it's a combination of general market research. So for example, I will, you know, I'll read all the financial news. I'll read the Wall Street Journal. I'll read, you know, notes that I get every morning about what's going on in the world. You know, I end up following news, politics, you know, anything that relates to the economy, which, you know, politics for better or worse, have a lot to do with sometimes. And then it's dealing with these specific situations. And what's interesting about it is that it's not sector specific. So, you know, one day I could be looking at a drug company. The other day I could be looking at a semiconductor company or an oil company. And so, you know, pretty quickly you have to familiarize yourself with the asset. And then the merger business itself is very legal because, you know, there's a contract and everything is about what's in a contract and what could lead the contract to be broken. And so some of that will be, you know, antitrust analysis, you know, as maybe some of the listeners have heard, some deals sometimes get blocked by for antitrust reasons, like competition. For example, you know, Rite Aid was trying to merge with Walgreens, and the government didn't let that go through. And you know, companies that people have heard of, it does happen somewhat infrequently, but it happens. So some of the work is looking at how companies compete, and, you know, for example, whether we think that the government's going to ultimately let it go through or not, with or without divestitures, and all this kind of research. And then also, you know, there's some fundamental work on trying to value companies, because whether because we think a company might get another bid or the deal might not go through, then it's very important to know what the company might be worth. And so we do more standard kind of like any equity, you know, stock analyst would do. We look at a company and see what we think it's worth.
Okay. Sounds good. And for listeners, this is another topic we've hit a little bit, but of course, there's a long history of chess grandmasters making a transition into finance. It's not like an automatic thing, but our mutual friend Dmitry Schneider is off in Asia now, working in finance. And then there's prominent people like Patrick Wolf, Luke McShane, David Norwood. So
Alex Fishbein in New York.
Boaz Weinstein making a killing.
He's not a grandmaster, but he's made a lot more money than any of us. So,
right, exactly. Yeah, and then you have like Peter Thiel, tangentially related subject, but obviously a chess player who's managed to scratch together a couple pennies. So one thing that I think younger listeners might have is, did chess help you get in the door of finance?
Yeah, so I think, you know, there's a couple of things that I say about that. First of all, in one word, absolutely. But then, you know, to elaborate a little bit, the very first job that I got, I would never have gotten without chess because the owner of the company was a guy named Sid Belzberg, who was a very wealthy guy from Canada who had a company called Belzberg Technologies, and he was the sponsor of the Canadian Olympic team, the chess team, for several years, and so I'd gotten to know him. And when I graduated from college, I decided to get in touch with him because, you know, I had tried sort of the standard, like applying to Goldman Sachs and Citigroup and Bank of America and Merrill and Lehman back then, Bear Stearns, you know, all those firms, and I wasn't really getting anywhere. So then I realized, you know, you got to talk to people that you know and just see if anything comes up. And so, you know, after speaking with him, at first the thought was that really he would put me in touch with people that he knew. Like he knew Carl Icahn, a very famous activist investor. He knew a bunch of other people. He was on the board of the Kasparov Chess Foundation, which has, you know, Stan Druckenmiller on it. But ultimately, you know, I think he decided that which was a good thing, he decided that I was a smart guy and he would rather just hire me himself. And so I got started working for him. You know, he was sort of expanding from a financial technology company into the brokerage business. But, you know, make a long story short, I would never have gotten that job without Chess because, you know, Chess is a really useful network of people that have mutual respect for each other. As a young chess player, you have to learn to harvest those relationships and at times, you know, leverage them into hopefully getting some work. Then the other thing I say is that, you know, in my day-to-day life, you know, I don't exactly broadcast like I'm a chess grandmaster, you know, so talk to me and I'm really smart. Right. I would never do that. But, you know, having been doing what I do for basically 10 years, I don't usually necessarily tell people that I was a chess player, that I am a chess player, I should say, but generally it comes out in some way, whether because someone else tells them or they just know from having known me for a long time. And I think, you know, having that as your background gives you a respect that other people have to earn in other ways and it takes time. And so I think that, you know, when I meet the CEO of a company or when I speak to, you know, someone at a bank that I want to get some information out of, it's very helpful that I often get an introduction as a really smart guy who's a chess player. And it's almost like as if I have a little bit of a leg up, in these relationships. And that's got value. That's hard to sort of pinpoint or evaluate, but it's definitely there. And it's followed me throughout. And I think it's been extremely useful.
Okay, so there you have it. So any young listeners should network and continue to study chess because the better you are, the more lofty an introduction you can get, such as what we will talk about with your of course crowning achievement of having beaten a certain Vishy Anand in a in the Olympiad, but we'll get to that later, because right now I just want to sort of tie together chess and finance just a bit more. So last sort of question for those listeners who are rolling their eyes saying, when are they going to talk about chess? We're getting there. But what would you recommend for younger, like, would you recommend getting in the finance field? It's notoriously competitive, but overall, do you like your work and feel like other chess players might like it?
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough question. I mean, I think the simple answer is, I'm happy with the way my life has turned out. So that's number one. Now, you know, finance is definitely a very tough world to get into. And I feel like the dominoes kind of fall into place in a way that is often unexpected. And so if you had told me, like, out of college where I would be 12 years later, I would have absolutely no idea. And when I applied for work coming out of college, for me, finance was this broad thing. I was thinking I was going to be, you know, an investment banker. Like, I didn't even know the difference between different, you know, sort of paths that you can have within finance. And so, you know, I think as a whole, it's a good place to be. Now, you know, the world has changed a little bit since, I'm sure, as most listeners have heard about, the financial crisis in 2008 did change a lot of things for hedge funds, but also for banks, and, you know, kind of put a cloud on the entire industry. That, you know, so I think that these sort of golden years of that finance was clearly like the number one thing to do are behind us, but it's still a great field, which can be very lucrative if things go well. And, you know, but it requires perseverance. It requires I think for chess players, sometimes what can be difficult, and what I've seen in the past, is that, you know, we think we're smart people and that we somehow deserve to have a job that exploits all of our skills and brain power. And the truth of the matter is, at least for me, is that at the beginning, you know, you start from the bottom, just like in anything. And, you know, I was working on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, getting people coffee, and they would have me go get their lunch. And, you know, I had to kind of to stomach it and just do it. And you know, it didn't last that long. And pretty quickly, I think I was able to distinguish myself and go up in the world. But it's something that you have to be willing to accept. And I think for especially the strongest players, that can sometimes be difficult for valid reasons. But, you know, yeah, it's a bit of a long-winded answer, I guess.
But. No, it's but it's good insight. And, you know, we've talked about this, Pascal, and I've talked about it a little on the show, but I myself sort of had that experience and have the scars on my back to prove it, because I didn't have delusions of grandeur about my chess abilities, but I had a pretty successful run in poker and then burnt out on poker. And because I did well in poker playing against basically people who weren't that good, I now, you know, you realize more in hindsight, I tried to trade independently for a while and didn't do terribly, but ultimately realized just how hard it was. And that's what brought me back to chess, is realizing, like, I can work on finance and poker and stuff like that, but I need having kids relates to it too, but need consistent income in order to pursue dreams like that. So it's tricky. I mean, if you're young, you can take lots of chances, but I am not that young anymore. I'm 40. So at some point you took your chances, and maybe they worked, maybe they didn't, but you move on. So I find it a fascinating field, but, like, you know, for every person like you who has ended up in a great situation, there may be others who just can't get in the door or try it on their own and end up recalibrating.
Yeah, and that's why it's such a tough question, because I know that, you know, it's not easy to get into it, and it can be frustrating. But, you know, at some point, if you're able to get, what I would say is that if you can get in the field or even around the field and be close enough, you know, a lot of movement happens laterally and vertically within one firm, and so, you know, sometimes that's what you have to do. And, you know, I've really enjoyed that. For me, the world of finance and trying to figure out what happens next, you know, both on a macro and on a micro level, it is, you know, like a game, and something that I think is really fun. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't 100 things that I have to do at my job that I wish I never had to do, but the part that I really do enjoy is looking at it kind of like a chess game on you know, what's going to happen next and how can I figure this out and you know, what are the chances I'm going to be right? And, you know, of course, as a poker player, you've been around this, but the big difference is that it's, you know, it's a game of incomplete information with a huge amount of randomness, you know, and outside factors that you really have no control over, you know, even less than when you're investing than you do in poker. And that's something that, you know, for a chess player like myself was a little bit difficult. Like, you have to admit that you're going to be wrong a lot. And, you know, the best hedge funds are wrong all the time. And, you know, they shine for a few years and then they don't shine. And that's, you know, and then you wonder whether it was all random or not. So,
yeah,
but we're getting into something else now.
Yeah. I mean, I may want to talk about that a little later, but let's get to chess. So I have a question.
Sure.
From listener and supporter of the podcast, Chris Wainscott. So Chris said, first, I'd like to say thank you, Pascal, for contributing a memory to my obituary for Savan Muradin a couple years ago. I always meant to reach back out and thank him, but that was such a crazy time. Thank him, being you. Second, with a full-time job and family life, how do you find time for chess? Specifically, knowing you have such a limited amount of time, how do you prioritize where to spend it?
Yeah, so I mean, it's. I think when I look at my life, there was the time before my son was born, and there's the time after. And for chess, I'd say that, you know, he's 17 months now, and you know, an absolute joy, and I love being a father, but. But for chess, it's definitely the time is more difficult to find, and the truth of the matter is that I haven't really played in tournaments in years. But people always, if people accuse me of being a retired chess player, I try to get mad at them and tell them that I'm not. I just don't have time to play. But you know, I follow chess tournaments. You know, like this morning, I was looking at the games in Weikanzhai. I play a lot of Blitz chess. And, you know, mostly online, and to the point where sometimes now when I see a board in 3D, I wonder how it works. But, you know, chess has obviously taken sort of a back seat, but I'm hopeful that, you know, in at some point in the future, I will be able to get back to it, you know, whether it's because, you know, I take a different career path after some time or just, you know, end up having more time, you know, as my son, and if I have other kids get a little bit older. But you know, the truth is I don't study chess, and when I do play, I wonder what opening to play, and it's a real struggle. And in fact, like that's the one thing I don't like about playing chess is figuring out what opening to play, because yeah. I've always played all sorts of things and I don't really know any of them anymore. So
right.
It's always difficult, but I do play a ton of Blitz, and I still do, and I think I have enough understanding to kind of get by, you know, against at least not really top level players. So, but you know, the fact is I don't really study chess anymore, and so you know, I can't say I'm doing a great job of managing everything and spending a lot of time on it.
Yeah, well, I can certainly relate to that. Not playing at your level, but I still enjoy playing a lot. But it's hard enough to find the time to play, let alone the time to study.
Yeah, and it's what you prioritize. Like, so at some point, you know, I had become pretty overweight, and you know, I decided that it should be a priority for me to be in good health. And you know, I even had like high blood pressure at some point, and I decided that being in shape should be a priority, and that, for example, took a lot of time, you know, that could have otherwise been spent on chess, but, you know, which I think was time well spent, and it worked out well. And you now I actually do CrossFit Greg.
Yeah,
I've been doing that for about 2 years, but before that I was just, you know, more of a regular gym goer, and I used to play tennis also. So I've, you know, my entire life as a kid, I played chess and tennis, and I think there wasn't one weekend when I wasn't playing either a chess or a tennis tournament, you know, from when I was 7 years old to 16, you know, I mean, I'm probably exaggerating, but essentially that's what it was. And you know, at some point I even kind of burnt out. So, you know, I think now I try to have a healthy balance between my work and family life, and the rest is kind of like, you know, if there's a little time, I'll play some Blitz. And, you know, my goal is not to really break any records in chess right now. It's more like, you know, I enjoy it, and because I enjoy it, I want to keep doing it. And then, you know, if at some point I can be competitive again, then hopefully I can be. And I think my style lends itself well to playing blitz, and you know, and I haven't suffered too much from the theory because I was never that theoretical of a player. But I'm obviously very rusty, and you know, I never have enough time to feel like I shake off the rust.
Right, and right now you're playing in the Pro Chess League and having to cross swords with world number 25, Luquang Liam, and people like that. That must be quite an experience.
Yeah, so the opening scares me to death in those games. And, you know, with white, I've actually had very good results just kind of playing garbage, like, not garbage, but very quietly, I would say. Like, I'll play, you know, the Reti and the English opening and, you know, I just try to be solid and then make it a game. But with black, you know, against those guys who are really well prepared, it's difficult. But, and the game with Luquang was actually kind of interesting. I mean, I think I misplayed the opening a little bit. And the thing is, the time control, 15 minutes with 2-second increment is tough, because I think that the 2-second is actually a hindrance. It would be better if there was no increment, because then you just play fast, but you feel like you have this 2-second increment. And in a lot of games, I end up with like no time and realizing that 2 seconds is really, like, you have to make a move instantly.
Yeah.
And against Luquang, I eventually flagged in a position that's probably objectively a draw. I mean, he has some slight chances, but it's probably a draw. There's not a lot of material on the board. And, like, I have an obvious capture of a bishop with my bishop with check, and for some reason I just froze and flagged.
Yeah, no.
Then, yeah.
It's interesting what you say about the increment. I hadn't thought about it. I don't really use them. So, I mean, I'll use longer ones when they're called for, but I have never used the 2-second increment, and I think I would have trouble with that too.
Well, so the chess world, you know, a lot of the top tournaments now have moved to a 30-second increment. And even when I started, when I, you know, played in Olympiad and stuff, towards the end, I think we were playing with the 30-second increment, which, you know, is a completely different ballgame, because you actually have a little bit of time to think and the moves don't just, you know, it's both sides, right? Like the back and forth, you have a little bit of time to see what you think your opponent is going to do and come up with what you think you're going to do. But with the 2 seconds, it becomes almost like bullet chess, if you know. And with the game with Luquang, he had 10 seconds, I had 10 seconds, and then I just flagged. So, you know, I actually feel vindicated when, or not vindicated, but I feel good when I just get to a situation like that where at least, you know, I got him to use his time. and he's someone who plays very fast. But, you know, the previous game, so I played for the first week of the league, which I guess was about 10 days ago now, my first game was against a guy named Shimanov, who I think is 2640 FIDE or something like that, and I played garbage opening. Actually, I think he had a move to be quite a bit better with black quickly, but then I played a great game. You know, I was a little bit better, and then I was much better, and then I was completely winning, and then I did what I made a decision that I think you do when you're rusty, which is I had a chance to trade queens into like a pawn up endgame. And I was just like, oh, that's so amazing. Like, let's just, you know, let's just trade queens. When in fact, like, if I kept the queens, his position is awful. It's like +5 on the computer or something like that. And +5 because of like, I can make 5 different moves. So it's not like, it's just completely
not one of those
over.
Fleeting +5s.
No. Yes. So, well, or like, it's a +5 that requires tremendous accuracy.
Precision, yeah.
Finding a complicated variation. But in this case, it was just like dominating completely position with a lot of ways to kind of break through.
Well, I mean,
but anyway, I ended up drawing that game.
And it's amazing that you can hold your own against those guys. I mean, I'm curious, like, how do you feel? Do you beat yourself up, like, based on the results?
Yeah, so last year I had a game against Caruana where it was, I think at some point it was mate in two, but the mate in two was not even important, but for, I think I was up a rook or something like that. And I ended up losing that game, and I was beside myself. I mean, obviously these are quick games, and, you know, it doesn't, you know, mean that much to win or lose, but I was, yeah, I beat myself up. And that's one of the reasons why I think it's difficult to play, is that I end up, you know, not sleeping the night after the games, because I'm just playing through the games in my head, and you know, I can't help it. And I've always kind of done that, but I think because I play less often now, you know, I get really sort of intellectually stimulated, or like my brain just can't turn off after I play. And so that's a little bit of a detriment. And that's why I don't even play every week during the Pro Chess League, I think, because, you know, it's hard on me if I have to wake up. I normally wake up to go to the gym at 4:45.
Wow.
So
I was going to ask you the secret to weight loss, and now I don't want to know.
Well, so, you know, I think I think the answer is, at least for me, it was pretty simple. I mean, and I had at some point I had a more standard, I've only been doing CrossFit for the last little bit, but I went from weighing, probably about 210 pounds at my most to weighing about 150 at some point. And, the dieting was really the key thing. I mean, I had sort of a typical finance lifestyle of going out to lots of dinners and drinking lots of alcohol and not going to the gym a whole lot. And, that's obviously not a healthy, and also my workplace has catered food of, where you might have some healthy options, but the unhealthy options are a lot easier to find.
Right.
I just kind of went full circle on that and started, eating a lot less carbs. Nothing that would be, groundbreaking in terms of method. I mean, cutting carbs out.
So did you cut them out entirely?
No, I never went for anything too drastic. But I did at some point, cut bread entirely. Mm-hmm. But I never cut vegetables or anything like that, because I actually don't really believe that that's a great thing. But obviously there's a lot of theories and people that know more than I do about that. But just eating better, started going to the gym. And, I think once the pounds came off a little bit, I just it almost became a challenge to weigh myself every week and make sure that I'd lost another pound, And but now I'm more I'm more in between, and I do a lot of weightlifting, and I'm nowhere near as good as Greg. So, he's very competitive. But
he'll be very glad to hear you say that.
Well, I mean, I think it's I'm not close enough to even be able to really pretend. So
yeah, Greg went out of his way to tell me that Wrench does CrossFit, but I can crush him. Greg tells me as if I was dying to know.
I'm pretty sure that Wrench can crush me also.
Okay.
But but I've had a good time with CrossFit, and when I first started, so I've been doing it for maybe a year and a half. I'm not sure exactly, but there's a workout that they call Murph that they do on Memorial Day, and it's a Murph, I guess was the name. Well, Murphy, I think was the name of a veteran who died in Afghanistan, I think. And his favorite workout was a workout of doing you do a mile run, then you do 100 pull-ups, 200 push-ups, 300 squats, and then you do another mile run, and you're supposed to do it with a weight vest on, the entire thing. And when I was first, a few months into doing CrossFit, I was like, this is completely impossible. I told myself that I would try to do it a year later. And so last year, last Memorial Day in May, I did it not without a weight vest. The weight vest is really, this workout is very hard, I think, without a weight vest, but I did manage to do it and do the 100 pull-ups, 200 push-ups, 300 squats, and the 2 mile runs, in a reasonable time. So I was very happy with that. But, with CrossFit and with most other things, I found that it's, it's humbling to see how good even, local, not competitive people can be. And I try to, keep the challenges to beat myself rather than the people next to me, because
right.
I think you got to know your limitations.
Yeah, yeah. I can't do. I mean, whatever. Of course, I could do CrossFit, but I haven't carved out the space. I mean, I'm aware that interval training is probably better for weight loss and for your overall health of your heart, but. For me, it's it's such a feat to actually get to exercise that to do sprints instead of jogging slowly at that time. I just don't have it in me at this moment in my life.
Do you run?
Yeah, I jog. I run outside when weather permits, mm-hmm. and I do the elliptical and swim a little bit if I'm at a gym. And for me, it's more just that I'm finally at an age where my metabolism has slowed down. So when my second daughter was born, I put on about 10 or, I mean, my second kid, my daughter, put on about 10 to 15 pounds that I'd like to get rid of. And I've just recently cut out carbs for breakfast and lunch is okay. My goal. So we'll see how it goes. But that started this year.
I think, it's just finding your own way is perfectly okay. I don't think people need to follow each other.
Yeah. Okay. So back to chess. And by the way, we should mention you play for the Montclair Sopranos. They've got Mark Arnold, former Perpetual Chess guest, Alex Lenderman, Sean Finn runs the team. So do you guys, do you get to see those guys at all?
Yeah, and we also have, I don't think he's played yet, but we have a 2700 playing for us this year, Bassem Amin from Egypt. So he's our he's our free agent,
gonna,
I guess.
Going to throw a tease out there. I'm working on getting him on Perpetual Chess, knock on wood.
All right, I'll try to tell him that you're
a decent guy. As you know, he's in Weekend Z now, so he has a good excuse.
Yes. But, yeah, so, you know, it's kind of funny to even think of Montclair Sopranos as having a team, because Montclair is a small place compared to, you know, New York, and but I'm actually one of the guys who lives in Montclair, and then Mac Molnar also grew up in Montclair, and Montclair, to give a little bit of background, is maybe a town of about 50,000 people. I guess you could call it a suburb of New York. It's maybe 15 miles away from Manhattan, so it's not very far. So I've actually hosted, since I have a house in Montclair, I've hosted a couple of get-togethers here, where, you know, we had a sort of a post-season party last year at my house, and I'm definitely going to try to set something up if I can get people together this year again. You know, obviously, I'm not sure if someone will come from Egypt for my party, but
right.
You know, I'll invite
your parties aren't that good.
Hey, you should come to one before you pronounce yourself.
Okay, I might take you up on that. Let's zoom out a little bit and talk about your broader chess career. So, of course, everyone, I teased it in to the Patreon subscribers of the podcast that obviously, I mean, you won the Canadian Closed Championship a couple times, which I had to dig into, like, does that mean you're Canadian champion or not? And I wasn't really able to resolve that question. So
yeah, the Canadian Closed is what they typically call the Canadian Championship.
Okay, so you can say you're two-time national champion then.
Yes, and sometimes I might have said it.
Okay, yeah, I would too in your situation. So, related question from Mike Klein, of course, who we both know. So Mike says, Canada plays top board in final round of the 2016 Olympiad. The 2017 Canadian Championship has a hugely controversial finish based on an upside-down rook-pawn promotion. A top Canadian GM leaves the World Cup due to his tire. A new Canadian GM-elect looks like a caveman by the time he completes his odyssey to get the GM title. And my question is, don't you miss it? Can family life compare? And what the heck is going on in Canadian chess?
It's a loaded question.
Many loaded questions. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So where to begin? I have to say Canadian chess has been doing, you know, great in terms of just having stronger players than when I was, you know, at the top. And it would certainly be a difficult championship to win again today. I think when I became a grandmaster, I was maybe the third Canadian-born GM, I think, and obviously there's several more, and also, you know, people who have come from other countries that make up the team, but like the bearded one he's referring to is one of the chess bras, Amon Hambleton, and I was actually really happy to see him get that title. I mean, I knew him a little bit, you know, when he was much younger and kind of up and coming, and you know, I was happy, and he's a local guy that I don't think had access to the same kind of training that, you know, American players might often have, you know, because in the U.S., you know, there's a lot of grandmasters who teach chess professionally, and it's possible to get really good coaching early on. You know, in Canada, it's not as easy, and it still isn't, I think. And so, you know, I'm always very happy to see other people do well there. But do I miss it? Yeah. I mean, I think the thing I struggle with the most with my choice of kind of going in a career, you know, in a completely different field is sort of that freedom that chess players have of, you know, traveling around the world with no real schedule, waking up when they want to, you know, going for a drink when they want to, you know, and not having to wake up at 4:45 every day to get to the gym so that you can get to work by, you know, a little bit after 7. So, you know, I think it's these are tough questions for anybody. I mean, I certainly don't regret, you know, the choices that I made, but these are things that I always wonder. Well, you know, what would life have been like otherwise? And you know, these are it's difficult.
Yeah.
But I do, yeah, absolutely. Do I miss, you know, going to Gibraltar? Well, actually, I never went to Gibraltar, but I would have liked to.
Yeah.
Do I miss going somewhere, you know, to play? You know, I remember going to Iceland as a absolutely wonderful place to play chess and just hang out. Yeah, I mean, I certainly do. And that's why, you know, I'm hoping that I can play again. Of course, the family life is that's a whole other question, but, you know, obviously I'm very happy to, you know, be married, have a son. And, you know, I think, it's an experience that can't really be described and that can't really be understood until you live it. At least I know I didn't understand it. And, you know, I don't know if you feel the same way, but
sure. Yeah.
It's definitely not, you know, it's definitely, you know, I think it's been amazing and I hope it continues to be. And, you know, I'm lucky. My son is great. And, you know, it's, so yeah, I wouldn't give that up, but do I miss the lifestyle? Oh yeah, of course.
Yeah, for sure. Okay.
But I get fun things too, right? Like I'm in a world where I get tickets to any game or event that I might like to go to. And, you know, I eat a lot of good food at good restaurants and, you know, it's all sort of pros and cons.
Yeah. I suspect most listeners don't feel too sorry for you. But
I wouldn't want them to,
but I get it for sure. Like, yeah, I mean, I've with two kids, I used to have a much more sort of freewheeling schedule as well. And yeah, it's something that you should treasure while you have it, if you have it.
Yeah, I guess there's two stages, right? Like the first stage was having, you know, a day job, you know, especially in something like finance, that's pretty time consuming. And then the second stage is fatherhood, and that takes it to a whole other level.
Yeah. So Pascal, you're the first guest I've had. You know, I try to get guests from all over the world, and somehow you're the first Canadian-born guest I've had. So, you know, you touched on it a little bit a minute ago, but why do you think it is that there's historically less of a chess culture in Canada and that they haven't produced as many top players?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'm not sure. I mean, I think when you look at the U.S., you know, things have changed for the better exponentially. I think, you know, since I've been a little bit away from chess, like the last 10 years or so. But there was a time when there weren't too many U.S.-born grandmasters, you know, either. And you know, I think that has changed in part because the access to information has become so much you know, everything is available much more easily today than it was when you know, I was a kid. And so that makes it, that kind of evens the playing field a little bit. But, you know, chess has just never had much financial support in Canada. And, you know, to give you a concept of it, like when I won the Canadian Championship, which was like a two-week tournament, and these were some that were actually sponsored, you know, it was like almost a two-week tournament. And I think first prize in one was maybe $2,000 Canadian, and in another one was maybe 2,500 or something like that. And these were good ones. Like there were some where there was literally no prize. And so, you know, if you're going to be a professional chess player in Canada, well, you're just not. Like, it's right. Not. You can't be. So you could teach, like many, you know, chess players do in the U.S. anyway, because it is hard to play even today. Or you could do the probably most well-known Canadian grandmaster Kevin Spraga did is move to Portugal, which is a country with reasonable living expenses, and play in Europe for a living, you know. I think because there is no case to be made for being a professional chess player within Canada, you know, you there's not that many who get to the level of being a professional player, you know. And I think even the people like Eric Hansen and you know, the newer generation, the younger generation, they, you know, don't spend that much time in Canada itself.
Yeah. Well, hopefully that their being from Canada and their being such great ambassadors for chess will help the next generation.
Well, absolutely. And I think that's one of the things that's great about chess today is that there's a lot of ways to reach, you know, greater audiences, you know, through the internet and other means. And so for people who are charismatic and who are, you know, good ambassadors of the game, there are a bunch of potential open doors, and, you know, and I think, you know, it's actually probably a great time, as great a time as ever to be a professional chess player today.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Especially when I've had guests like John Donaldson and John Watson, it really puts in perspective just how much harder it was, say, 20, 30 years ago. So,
yeah, I was thinking the same when I was listening to the John Donaldson podcast. You know, and he was talking about those guys that I had heard of, but I don't think I ever realized the extent to which it was a struggle to do what they did, you know, back in the, I don't know, 60s, 70s.
Yeah, Ross Alimo as a cab driver is my favorite one. I mean, question. Okay, so we've got to get to your crowning achievement, Pascal. In the 2006 Olympiad, you had quite a game against Anand. So here's a question from Paul Canalupo. What was the primary reason you were able to beat Anand? How did you prepare for the game?
The thing is, as much as I do think it's, you know, the game, the most memorable game I've ever played, you know, for me, the tournament itself was actually pretty mediocre. I didn't have a great tournament. I think even after beating Anand, which, you know, you only win 10 rating points for that, but I think I still lost rating in that tournament.
You only win 10 rating points for that. Well, most of us would get more than that, but anyway,
well,
go on.
Yes, but, you know, the point being that it came at an unexpected time because I didn't play very well. Now, it also came at, for me, sort of a great time because it was literally weeks before I would start, you know, working on Wall Street, and I didn't know when I would be able to play chess in any kind of serious way again. And so, you know, there's a few things. First, you know, in terms of game preparation, we had a coach for this Olympiad, and that was because Sid Belzberg, the guy who ultimately hired me, he was paying for a coach, and we weren't getting paid much to play, but the coach was Lev Psahis, who is, you know, some people might know his name. Yeah. I think he's written a few books. He was, you know, the champion of the Soviet Union back in, I have no idea what year. But he, you know, very solid, very, you know, very knowledgeable player, and even more so maybe coach. And he recommended, and when you prepare for Anand, by the way, it's not an easy thing because he plays all kinds of stuff, right? So he plays different Sicilians. He plays the Caro Kann. He plays e4, e5. You know, he could play anything. And back then I was mostly playing e4. And so, you know, I didn't really know what to expect, but the Taimanov was one of the things that we considered. And, you know, the line that I chose is just a line that's fairly easy for white to play and where it's not so easy for black to get, you know, sort of an active position. And so we thought that was a good strategy, you know, when you're playing someone so strong who might kind of, you know, try to steamroll you, you know, or get you in a theoretical variation that you don't know as well. So, you know, the opening choice, I definitely owe to him because it wasn't a line that I would necessarily, I was always pretty aggressive. So I probably would have gone for one of the lines where I castled queenside and gotten myself in trouble because I didn't know the line well enough quickly. So for that, I thank him. And then, you know, I just played a good game and he at some point went for a somewhat over-aggressive plan and I found the right ways to counter it. And then, you know, the game ended with a nice move that, you know, at least is nice for like a, it's always nice when you end a game and it's like, it can be a little puzzle. Like it's not a difficult puzzle, but you know.
No, it's pretty, it's a pretty finish. I looked at the game this week. It's a really nice game. I recommend people check it out.
Yeah, so it's you know, so it's definitely, it was a moment like I almost couldn't believe it when it happened, especially because I was not having a particularly good tournament. And so, yeah, I mean, it's also like, you know, I think the difference between grandmasters is not that, you know, incredibly high. And I think sometimes, you know, sometimes you do win some and, of course, also lose some. But right. For me, you know, if I have to speak to the moment I'm the proudest of in my chess career, it wouldn't be that one. So because, you know, that was a great game and, you know, I'm happy I played it, but it's one game and there's a limit to how much I think one game can mean. But a moment that people might not know about, you know, I think it was maybe written about somewhere, but it's more obscure and maybe for someone else that wouldn't be what they think of, but I had the chance to play Karpov at some point when I used to work as a chess commentator or do sort of, you know, coaching and different things around chess when I was in college, when I was at UMBC. And I went to Lindsberg, Kansas, when Karpov was going to, I think he was playing a match against Polgar, and that was before he was playing a rapid match in New York against Kasparov. And it was a funny setup where I just got, you know, got out of the plane, and I was on my way to the chess club. I get to the chess club, and Karpov was playing some blitz games just to prepare himself. And he was playing, I think he played a couple of games against Grandmaster Yuri Shulman, and he played a couple of games against Anna Zatansky, who's, you know, one of the top women players in the country. And so I show up, and I still have my suitcase in my hands. And Yuri, who's a, you know, very friendly, you know, sort of funny guy that I'm friends with, said, you know, Pascal, like, you got to sit down and try to play Anatoly, because he's, you know, he's been beating us left and right, and we haven't won a game yet. And so I sit down, and, you know, obviously Karpov is feeling very confident. He just got a glowing introduction from Yuri. And then the first game, I crush him.
Nice.
And this is, I think, three or five minute games. And then, you know, he rolled up his sleeves and was like, all right, let's play. And I think we played about 20 games, and I was about 50-50. I mean, I think, depending on whether one game was a draw or not, which was kind of a, that's another story, but I'll skip that story. But basically, I scored 50-50 in that somewhat long blitz match against Karpov, who was motivated to win, I think. And, you know, a few weeks later, he beat Kasparov in a rapid match. And so for me, that was probably the moment where I was like, wow, like, I actually managed to compete. You know, it's blitz, but, you know, it's Karpov. And a few weeks later, he beat Kasparov. And for me, that's probably the proudest moment in my chess career.
Understandable. That's amazing. So do you remember any of the games?
No. Okay. It's been so long. And, I was never good about writing things down. And it's unfortunate. But, you know, there were witnesses.
Oh, that's good.
Yeah. It's not a made-up story.
No, I know you well enough to know you wouldn't make it up, but you might want to get those people on the record just to be safe, you know.
Yeah. I mean, but I'm also not trying to, trying to achieve anything.
That's an incredible story, and I love to hear stories about, like, the brushes with the legends. Do you have any others from your travels?
Yeah, I mean, I think I was, in a sense, like, as much as Canada didn't have too much of a chess scene, the good thing about being Canadian champion was that, you know, at the time I was a unique commodity, right? I was the champion of a country that people didn't really have players, you know, in their tournaments from. And at Olympiad and other places, I got to play and got to know many people, like, from, you know, I know Aronian from being a kid. We played in the same, you know, World Youth. We were around the same age. I had games against, you know, Aronian, Nigel Short, Radjabov, Ivanchuk, you know, and all, I mean,
that's incredible.
All the players I've named so far, I at least drew.
Wow.
But then I lost also, but, like, one of the biggest misses I had was another Olympiad. I was up a piece against Radjabov, and he was younger then, but he was still over 2,700. And I ended up drawing that game, and that was another one that I let slip. And I think in general, I in my chess career, I'd say more often than not, I handled pressure well, and I was always extra motivated. I think motivation was always a big issue for me in chess, but when I played the really, really top players, I was always so competitive. And I do feel like in chess and in tennis and in almost anything, like, sometimes you just feel like you get into a zone and you're on somehow. And, you know, I think for me, that happens sometimes, you know, in these games with, you know, Anand or that match with Karpov. And, you know, if only I had sort of the ability to replicate it, I think, you know, as a competitor, I could have done good things, but I have lots of stories with Aronian, you know, and because I knew these guys from way back, and a lot of them are now, you know, strong players. I have stories with Dekaru also.
Right. I'm sure. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I saw Aronian, last year in the summer, and, because he was, you know, staying somewhere close to New York City before going to St. Louis to play. And the person he was staying with knew that, you know, I knew him from the past and somehow got us together. We played basketball. We played a couple of blitz games. I lost one and won one.
All right. Wow.
Actually, and
what's his basketball game? We already got a so Magnus scouting report, so now we need a
Yeah, so he loves playing basketball, but I wouldn't say, you know, I wouldn't say that he's the best basketball player ever, but he's not so bad. He needs to pass the ball a little bit more, but you know, that's okay.
We had
a fun time.
Nice. Excellent. Yeah, I mean, he's known to have a lot of interest, so.
Yeah, he's a very charismatic. You know, I love his playing style. Actually, I think he's a great combination of sort of quiet but deadly, and very sneaky. And he calculates, I think, as well as anyone. So I've always liked his chances as one of the contenders. But of course, you know, nerves also play a huge part in these outcomes at the end of the day.
Yeah, of course. And speaking of which, you mentioned that you feel like one of your strengths was handling pressure well, and we also talked a bit about the Anand game, the Bishop E7 move in particular that ended the game. So, like, when you see a move like that, how much are you able to just calculate versus how much are you, like, is there a voice in your head saying, I'm playing Anand, I must be missing something, like, I'm playing Anand, what's going on here? Like, are you able to just shut all that out and just focus on the calculation?
Yeah. You know, I think at that point there was no doubt in my mind that I was winning, because, you know, the material situation was pretty clear, and, you know, for even body language, you know, it was somewhat obvious that things were not going well for him. But also, I think, and this may be delusion on my part, but I was never particularly afraid of people, you know, and I think I always played, you know, to win, and you know, except for the opening, where I always, you know, felt really like I was at a disadvantage, I always, you know, felt like I could compete. And that's probably somewhat delusional, but it helped me in situations like that, because I don't think I was like, oh my God, it's impossible that I'm winning. Like, for me, it was like, all right, well, it looks like it's made, so right. Maybe it is. And I didn't actually spend very long on Bishop B7. Like, I knew pretty quickly. And then when I played it, he resigned instantly. So, you know.
Yeah, he saw it coming. Wow, amazing. And so, I mean, in hearing these stories, I mean, I've, you know, we've known each other a long time. I've known you were a grandmaster. I hadn't heard all of these, because we talk, you know, more about general life than, like, you know, going in the Wayback Machine. But so, yeah. So why do you think it is, like, I'm almost a little surprised that your peak rating's only 25-10. I mean, it sounds like you're really able to hold your own against some heavyweights. So what do you think held you back in slower, like in classical chess?
Yeah, so I think I have, you know, obviously I've been talking more about my positives than my negatives in this podcast so far, but, you know, I had huge problems with consistency, first of all. Like, when I played, I never did very well in open tournaments in the U.S. because, you know, I had a tendency to have, you know, one good game, one bad game, you know, and like I said, I think, you know, openings were a big problem. So sometimes I would get in trouble. Like, I mean, even in the Pro Chess League 2 weeks ago, you know, the one game with Black, the very last game I played, I got a horrible position out of the opening. I played too slowly, and I didn't have even a fighting chance to do anything in that game. So, you know, there were moments like that as well. And they didn't happen as much, I think, against the really heavyweights, because I was just so focused. I didn't, you know, and I really wanted to do well. But, you know, I guess at other times I didn't. And I think, you know, to be fair, I think I got stronger as I went through my college years, but, you know, I didn't get the chance to play that much after that. And so, you know, at the end of college, I was feeling pretty confident about how I was playing. And, you know, at UMBC, we had the chance of having some very strong players. There was Alex Onuschuk, who's, you know, still one of the best players in the U.S. And at the time, you know, was the U.S. champion at some point and always a contender, and still is. Alex Vojkovic, you know, who sadly passed away, you know, a few years after I graduated, which that was a really sad story. But I spent a lot of time with those guys. Also, Elvis was always around the campus. Mm-hmm. So I spent a tremendous amount of time, like, looking at chess and playing blitz with those guys, you know, because it wasn't really formal training, but we would look at games. And especially with Alex Onuschuk, who was a very good friend of mine at the time, and, you know, I felt like I could analyze with him, and I think he felt that I could, you know, hold my own very well, you know, and he was a 2700 player. And so I think my practical results were always well below my analysis, and even like, so, and I don't really know that I found, you know, all the reasons for it, you know, because, you know, at some point I decided to do something else. And so I never quite got to the dark side of all my weaknesses, you know, but
right.
of which there were plenty. You know, I had a tendency to blunder. I had a tendency. I mean, we all have our issues. I said that I handled pressure well, but when I was a kid, I used to throw up before almost every single game that I played. And so, you know, well, for a time period, not, you know, my entire childhood, but that, you know, I went through a period where it's not so much that I think nerves affected my play, but I couldn't control like that physical effect of it, you know, and that was something that was embarrassing as a growing, you know, boy/teenager, I can't help but have a feeling that I never achieved my potential, but you know, that's probably a feeling that most people have, frankly, because, you know, I think everyone has a lot of potential, but it's sometimes hard to, you know, it's hard for anyone to achieve their full potential.
Right. For sure. And I don't want to get too much into like your whole background as a kid, but how old were you when you started playing chess? Just out of curiosity.
Yeah. So I would say I have a pretty like standard chess story. Like my parents taught me the moves when I was about five. You know, I think I played my first tournament when I was in first grade. And you know, after that I played scholastically. I wasn't like one of those kids who progressed at like an absolutely incredible, you know, rate, I think. But you know, I was a good chess playing kid. Like I think I was, you know, an expert in Quebec, and our ratings were very difficult when I was about 11, which probably is about like at the time would have been about 2200 US CF rated. But then I didn't really reach like, you know, like the IM level till I was maybe 15. And then another good moment I had as a kid was when I was 16, a guy in Montreal that was organizing some of the round robins that we had there. And you know, and those were actually great tournaments that I played in as a teenager. He organized a 6-game match between me and a grandmaster from Greece named Igor Miladinovich. And he was maybe 26 years old, something like that. And he had been world junior champion several years back. And, you know, I think he was rated about 2575, which, you know, back then, you know, is probably more like, I don't know, 2650 now. He was a tough player, and I expected to get like crushed. And I saw he played all kinds of openings, and somehow I won that match 3.5 to 2.5. And in match play, that was probably my best match ever, you know, and that's when I was 16, I think. So
nice.
That gave me motivation to keep playing. Yeah.
Cool. And did you have like much in the way of, were you able to get lessons and stuff as a teenager? Like once you started to get strong enough where you needed help, were you able to get it? Or
yeah, so I actually, you know, I was fortunate that my parents got me a coach. His name is Richard Berube, and he's really the only coach I had in my life. And he was I think he was a FIDE master, and definitely a better coach than player. Like he didn't play all that much, but he was a great coach, and he also coached for a while Le Siège, who was, you know, one of the like sort of the guy that I looked up to as a kid. You know, he was maybe 7 or 8 years older than me, something like that, and you know, became a grandmaster at a young age, and he was a really talented player. So the coach I had also had coached him at some point. So yeah, I mean, I had private lessons with him maybe till my early teenage years, and after that, you know, I think more than others, I was pretty self-taught. Like, I had weird, you know, I started to play on the internet, you know, really when I first got an internet connection, which was maybe in like 97 or something like that. You know, when you had the modem that dials, you know, I feel bad that our kids might never know what that was like.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I played on the fix, like the free internet chess server. And then I started playing on ICC. And I think I learned a tremendous amount from playing grandmasters because I didn't have access to that kind of training. And, you know, I actually think that playing grandmasters as a young master, even though there were blitz games, like even in blitz games, I think, you know, really strong players are able to show extremely high level ideas that they've just seen before because it's just a pattern, right? And the pattern replicates itself. And so, you know, you get to appreciate all these ideas and sort of, in a competitive, environment. And, you know, so rather than go through thousands of books, and I did read books, but, you know, I did a lot of practical, like I played a lot. So,
okay, maybe yeah.
More so than the kids, you know, today, you know, are studying, and it's probably more efficient, but, you know, that was my path.
Yeah, and there are several guests we've had who had sort of learn by doing type training, like, you know, Greg Shahade played tons of Blitz, Hikaru, like tons of Blitz. So it's a fun way to train if it works for you. Yeah. I mean, studying can be fun too. And like learning the history and like, cranking out some study that takes half an hour or something like that can be rewarding in its own right. But
yeah,
but Blitz, you get that instant feedback, that dopamine hit. So.
Yeah, listening to your podcast has made me feel like I should go back and read some history books, you know, like all this stuff about Fisher and Lombardi and those guys, especially, you know, the American players. You know, there's a lot of really interesting stories. So I do feel compelled to when I find some time to go back and look at that.
I'm right there with you. And we should both get back to our families, Pascal. But before I let you go, and this has been awesome, of course, we need to ask for improvement advice. You just touched on some, but do you have any book recommendations or just general advice for any listeners who are out there hitting the books?
Yeah, I mean, sure. So first of all, I guess, you know, and some of that is style, but I think my favorite chess book is the book by Michael Tal, that's called, I think, My Life in Games,
right?
Which, you know, is sort of a biography and a chess book, and there's a lot of games, and, you know, I think in this day and age, sometimes, you know, there's a little bit less creativity in chess, and just going through that is incredible. I actually just gave my copy to somebody, and I have to buy a new copy, but so that's one book. And then, you know, obviously I haven't kept up with all the books that come out now, and I have no doubt, you know, everyone seems to be talking about a few a few great books. So I might not be the best person with the newer books. But, you know, I still feel like some of their historical collections, like whether the Great Predecessors or even like Zurich 53, which was probably the classic, you know, book when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Are still books that, you know, personally, I like the books that combine sort of stories and chess, you know.
Me too.
So, you know, those are some of these, but you know, it's such a different world now than it was, you know, the opening books are a completely different level and you know, just a lot of great material, because I think it's easier to come up with the material with all the tools that are at our disposal. And, you know, it's the same thing in finance. You know, what took 10 hours to do might take one, you know, today compared to 15 years ago. And so the world is evolving in great ways.
Yeah, it really is. It's amazing how much information about everything is available. Okay, well, Pascal, this was awesome. I knew you would be a good guest, but I didn't know you had so many stories. So this was quite a treat.
Well, thanks, Ben. And as you can tell, I listen to your podcast quite a bit, and I think it's been a great thing to have. And you know, I'm one of those guys who commutes to work on a daily basis, and I really appreciate the time you spend doing it. I think it's awesome.
Cool. Yeah, as a commuter myself, those you guys are my people. The commuters
Yeah, I mean, I commute in a car, but I'm sure like the train and buses are also good candidates for podcasts.
Yeah, exactly. Cool. Well, thanks again, and good luck in the Pro Chess League. Good luck to the Montclair Sopranos as well. We'll be watching. And anyone who hasn't seen Pascal's, unfortunately, we can't see your games against Karpov, so we'll have to settle for your game against Anand. They should take a look.
Sure.
Cool. Well, thanks a lot, Pascal, and I will see you in person sooner or later.
Thanks, Ben. I hope so.
Special shout out to my PayPal and Perpetual partners. I spend about 5 hours a week working on the show, and while I love doing it, it can be hard to find the time. Without these people, the show would not be possible. So, special thanks to Adrian Gutierrez, Alex Pejas, Chris Wainscott, Coach J's Chess Academy, Chris Flanagan, Gary Andrews, I am Greg Shahade, Jason Dunbar, Jennifer Valens, John Fernandez, WGM Jen Shahade, Jens Green, Johnny McMenamin, Kelly Palmer, Krishna Gopala Krishnan, Macaulay Peterson, Matthew Tedesco, GM Pascal Charbonneau, Paul Sweeney, Peter Lux, Ricky Grijalva, Rob Lazorchek, WGM Tatya Vabrahamian, Tim Seymour, Todd Bryant, Victor Vrankulj, FM Zhao Cheng, and Zhivko Stoyanov. Thanks a lot, guys. I will catch you next week.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.